From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Yes, morning, Roy Bourgeois, good to be with you.
Father Roy Bourgeois will be debating a Pentagon spokesperson. It's been 22 years since the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero, gunned down by graduates of the former U.S. Army School of the Americas. But first, we'll speak with Jennifer Harbury, who argued her case before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday, the case of her murdered husband, Ephraim Bamaka Velasquez, a Mayan commandante in Guatemala. Then, part two of Johann Galtung, the founder of peace studies, talks about the lessons of war. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan has condemned Israel's offensive in the West Bank and Gaza as tantamount to all-out war. In a strongly worded letter to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, Annan said hundreds of innocent non-combatant civilians, men, women, and children, have been injured or killed, and many buildings and homes have been damaged or destroyed. Last week, for the first time, the Secretary General described the Israeli occupation of Arab lands as illegal, his strongest public statement to date on the 18-month-old Palestinian uprising. Vice President Dick Cheney said today he would meet with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat in the Mideast at some future date. He said he would only meet with the leader, however, if a truce takes hold. Under pressure from the United States, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said he would lift a travel ban on Arafat to allow him to attend a crucial Arab summit next week. Coming on the heels of the mass protests in Spain at the European Union summit, thousands of people have taken to the streets of Monterrey, Mexico, to demonstrate against the International Conference on Financing for Development. The meetings include the finance, trade, and foreign ministers of the world's most powerful countries. Corporate CEOs and other big business power brokers are also participating in what is billed as a summit to discuss alleviating poverty. These businesses say they want to create what they call a global clearinghouse to help investors get fast, accurate information on the developing world. President Bush arrives at the summit on Thursday. Marches and demonstrations are planned throughout the week. The Bush administration is threatening to cancel $40 million in financial aid and loans if it does not hand over more of its citizens wanted by the Hague War Crimes Tribunal. The threat came yesterday after Secretary of State Colin Powell met with Chief War Crimes Prosecutor Carla Del Ponte in Washington. The U.S. Congress has set a deadline of March 31st for Belgrade to comply with its demands that more Serbs be handed over to the tribunal. These threats come despite the fact that Serbian authorities violated the Yugoslav Constitution by extraditing former President Slobodan Milosevic last year. Milosevic calls his extradition a kidnapping and has repeatedly pointed out the country's Supreme Court ruled his extradition was illegal under Yugoslav law. Milosevic's transfer to The Hague came after what Yugoslav officials called economic blackmail by Washington. The U.S. has also threatened other countries with losing aid packages if they ratify the treaty on the establishment of an international criminal court that would have jurisdiction over U.S. officials accused of war crimes. The New York Times is reporting that federal prosecutors in Virginia and New York are seeking the death penalty for Zacharias Massawi, the so-called 20th hijacker in the September 11th attacks. The move is expected to be approved in Washington and announced in court next week. Officials would not say if the prosecutors had received the final approval from the Justice Department needed to pursue the death penalty, but they said the approval was all but certain given Attorney General John Ashcroft's strong support of capital punishment. The case is scheduled for trial this fall in Alexandria, Virginia, outside Washington. Nine states asked a judge yesterday to impose tougher penalties against Microsoft, citing internal memos as evidence the software giant had persisted in thwarting competitors, even as it was being found guilty of antitrust violations. The states asked a U.S. district judge to force Microsoft to create a stripped-down version of its flagship Windows software that could incorporate competitors' features and to divulge the blueprints for its Internet Explorer browser. The latter software dominates the web browser market and is a centerpiece of Microsoft's internet-based business strategy. Both sides made opening statements in a court proceeding to determine whether Microsoft should face additional penalties beyond those in its antitrust settlement with the federal government last fall. The states opened their case by airing Microsoft executives' words and emails and internal memos detailing how the company responded to threats from competitors.
Beam me up, Scotty, beam me up. Oh, I've seen enough to kill someone and come leave my supper like hardware. A tupper, this government is sealed, but the leaks from the geeks left this banana peeled and rotten. Like Johnny, not forgotten, like the air wax. Mowed down a race, so an inch grow out of paratracks. Who cares about the facts? We got food on the table. Say thanks, cause a giver was a reason for the fable. Oh my god, I've heard it from the smallest tweets. Leave it if you hate it, but check the foreign policy. South America, we found it like a hooker. Avoid the Middle East, cause Bush is in a snooker. Arms for oil, it's military protection. Here comes corporate America and George's got an erection. Jury selection, get 12 races, the acquittal. King is beating census, tell me what is the riddle?
Burn, 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 burn,
burn, burn, burn, burn, burn, burn, burn, Tricks of the Shade. You are listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Human rights lawyer Jennifer Harbury stood before the Supreme Court on Monday to argue her right to sue the U.S. government for covering up the murder of her husband, Guatemalan rebel leader Efraim Bamaca Velasquez. Harbury filed several lawsuits against the U.S. government and individual officials, charging they repeatedly lied to her about what they knew of her husband's death. Among the officials cited in the case are former Secretary of State Warren Christopher, former National Security Advisor Anthony Lake, and five other White House and State Department officials. While a federal judge dismissed her initial case, an appeals court reinstated parts of the suit, leading the State Department to seek review by the Supreme Court. That review was heard yesterday. We're joined now by Jennifer Harbury. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you for inviting me, Amy.
Well, can you explain what happened yesterday in the Supreme Court? You argued your own case?
Yes, I did. I have been practicing law for 25 years, and needless to say, I'm very familiar with each and every sheet of paper and statement ever presented by any of the petitioners, so I was very comfortable arguing. There was only one constitutional issue presented to the court yesterday, and that is whether or not State Department and other government officials could tell me they had no information at all and tell Congress they had no information at all for a period of more than a year while they in fact knew my husband was alive, being tortured by people on CIA payroll and would shortly be imminently and extrajudicially executed. Could they do that? Could they block my rescue to prevent me from going to court for emergency injunctive relief to save his life? That was the question presented yesterday.
Now, this seems to be somewhat of a technicality in terms of your husband's case, or is it central to what happened to him in Guatemala?
There would have been two lines that I would have considered central. One would be directly seeking damages for violation of his constitutional rights, but the court below had ruled that the Constitution does not apply outside the United States to non-citizens. Although certainly back in 1992 and 93, I could have sought injunctive relief for him, court orders that the CIA stop paying as torturers, because torture is outside the delegated authority of any government official in this country since the time of the revolution. It has always been prohibited. But very closely connected to that claim, of course, is the fact that I was not allowed. I was blocked from saving his life. I could have rescued him had I been timely told he's alive, he's being tortured by these people who happen to be on CIA payroll. I could have gone to the courts of law for an order to save his life as a U.S. citizen myself. So both avenues were blocked.
What exactly did the U.S. government tell you at the time, and when was it?
These were numerous conversations starting in March of 1993 when I first found out from an escaped prisoner of war that he was alive and that the Army had faked his death so that they could torture him for his information. At that time, I had no idea that the CIA was involved directly in that torture. And what the State Department officials and other U.S. officials told me and told the United States Congress in writing for the next 2 years is that we have no information. We're very concerned. We're going to do everything we can to investigate and find out what happened. We'll get back to you right away on this. We're doing everything we can. The Army says they don't have them. What more can we do? We have no information at all, but we're trying so hard.
So what were the questions that the Supreme Court justices asked you on Monday, asked you yesterday as you stood before the High Court?
Well, there were a number of questions. You know, for example, how quickly could you have got that information if you had started a Freedom of Information Act request earlier, for example, since the government didn't have to just come out and tell me, but they weren't allowed to lie to me. If they had just said no comment, then I would have filed, you know, my FOIA and gotten the information that way. Or, of course, they could have just given it to me, which their own legal office told them in writing later. So some of the questions revolved around how long it would have taken to get that information, how long was he actually alive. Of course, the courts normally will not interfere with the sphere of power of the other two branches of the government, either legislative or executive. So questions arose that were, you know, along the lines of, is this a political question or a matter of foreign affairs that we should not interfere with? Also, just what would have been the legal grounds that you would have gone into court back in 1993 to save his life if he didn't have constitutional rights? What other grounds would you have gone in on? And with that, I was able to discuss torture always being outside the authority of any U.S. government official and was able to quote some very amazing words from Patrick Henry, in fact, some 200 years ago when our country remembered very, very well what it was like to have a bitter war fought on our own soil, and Congress was thinking about permitting torture under unusual circumstances, arguing that the government needed that flexibility and strength. And Patrick Henry literally said, should we allow that, then we are, quote, lost and undone as a society. Those were the types of questions we addressed yesterday.
How long were you before the court?
All attorneys are permitted 30 minutes to speak.
And when will they hand down their decision, and what difference will it make to you in the case? Will it determine whether it, in fact, can go forward at all?
It will depend a lot on what grounds they either accept it on or turn it down on. If I win that round in the court, then my case for violation of the constitutional right to access to the courts goes back to the district court, and we proceed with a trial on the merits with the discovery and stuff. If they deny relief in this case, then what happens really depends on the grounds they deny it on. I still have tort claims actions in the lower court that are going on.
What about Warren Christopher and Anthony Lake? Why them specifically, the former National Security Advisor and Secretary of State?
Well, the Secretary of State certainly was aware, we allege in the complaint, that all of the higher-ups were aware of exactly what was happening. There was huge inquiry coming in from Congress, as well as all the human rights groups, as well as myself. And clearly there was a decision made to cover up the fact that he was alive and being tortured and that the United States government was directly involved. And that by covering it up and throwing me off the track with intentionally deceptive statements, they kept me from saving his life, which is what I would have done. As for Mr. Lake and the others, when I went to them after the 60 Minutes expose, they did admit that their document referred to in the 60 Minutes expose was in fact correct, and they did have that, but they insisted they had scraped the bottom of the barrel, quote unquote, and that there was no further information, and that's what led to my third hunger strike. There was in fact a great deal of information in there still.
Jennifer Harbury, who argued against you in the Supreme Court yesterday?
Mr. Cordray was attorney for the petitioners, and Solicitor General Ted Olson spoke for 10 minutes.
And the main point of the Solicitor General, interesting that he would then, in a sense, be arguing for the U.S. Solicitor General under Bush for Lake and Christopher.
Yes. It was a 10-minute discussion, and his point, as was mostly Mr. Cordray's points, is that sometimes the government needs to be able to lie. And my response to that is you can always say no comment. You can also say we can neither confirm nor deny. That's what those Glomar denials are for. But you cannot lie if the purpose of lying is to prevent someone from going to a court of law to legitimately present a grievance and when it's a life or death situation, as in this case. that in those circumstances, that's intolerable.
And finally, what is the latest in the case of the murder of your husband? You've repeatedly said killed by officers on the payroll of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly do you know at this point, and what has happened in your search for your husband, Efraim Bamaca Velasquez's bones in Guatemala?
Well, we did go to a reparations hearing. As you know, we won the international case at the Inter-American Court of the Organization of American States. There was a full trial of the Guatemalan military, and we received a 100-page unanimous opinion against the army last December. And last fall, we went in for the reparations hearing, and just last week, interestingly enough, we got a very large opinion and an award in the reparations hearing out of that court against the Guatemalan government. It's a very large monetary award, and which I've already committed to sending completely to the family. I want his sisters and his many nieces and nephews to have that money and be able to obtain the education that they need.
How much is it?
Close to $500,000, which for the Inter-American Court is a very sizable award, one of the largest that they've ever given.
Will the Guatemalan government pay it?
I believe that the civilian government, after a bit of uproar, will pay it, but it won't be easy. But what I was going to say, the most remarkable thing about that reparations opinion is that they have now said, and this sets a precedent for all of the other cases, that as part of the reparations, they must return the dead. They must give his body back to me. Now, the civilian government can't do that. Only the army can do that. And I predict it will be a battle, but I want his body back. And the court has supported me on that. So that came in as a gift to me last week, which, interestingly enough, was also the 10th anniversary of his capture.
That was March 12th, 1992.
Yes.
And so now, at this point, how can you find out where his body is?
Well, the court has ordered them to get his body and give it back to me. So I'm going to wait a little bit and start communicating through the OAS system and stuff to find out exactly what they plan to do. But I'm sure they're discussing that even as we speak.
And how you know that the killers were on the payroll of the U.S. government, of the CIA?
That information came from a number of sources. But the Intelligence Oversight Board, for example, after President Clinton ordered a sweeping investigation, reported that several of them were on CIA payroll. I also have plenty of information from inside witnesses, and of course, Senator Torricelli a number of years ago reported that Colonel Alpidez was a paid asset of the CIA, and that is the colonel who was seen bending over my husband's torture table in July of 1992 when he was injected with a toxic gas that caused him to swell grotesquely and left one arm and leg heavily bandaged as if they had hemorrhaged. Colonel Alpidez received $44,000 from the CIA that same month. That's roughly 40 times that's roughly 20 or 30 times the average annual income of a Guatemalan citizen.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Up next, we're going to have a discussion about the School of the Americas. If you could stay for any portion of that, we would appreciate that. Is there any evidence that the people who were involved with your husband's death, the Guatemalan officers, had any involvement or training at the School of the Americas?
Colonel Alpidez was at the School of the Americas, I believe, twice. He also is on the DEA corrupt officer list as a drug runner, but of course our country has made no efforts to extradite him or bring charges against him. 8 to 12 of the persons directly implicated in my husband's torture and murder within military intelligence are School of the Americas graduates. I would say they had substantial implication in his murder.
We've been speaking with Jennifer Harbury. Her husband was captured March 12, 1992. Efraim Bamaca Velasquez captured in an ambush by Guatemalan soldiers. They initially said that he killed himself after battle, but in early 1993, another captured guerrilla escaped and reported that Bamaca had been taken alive and was being tortured at a military base. We will wait to hear what the Supreme Court decides about the case of Jennifer Harbury and if she was denied her constitutional rights when the U.S. government lied to her about the whereabouts of her husband. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by Father Roy Bourgeois, who's a leader of the movement to close, what was called for many years the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. We'll also be joined by a Pentagon spokesperson. And finally, we'll hear the words of Johann Galtung, founder of Peace Studies, a speech he gave this weekend in New York. Stay with us. Underworld, Betty, you are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, we've just come out of the six-month anniversaries of September 11th, the terror attacks that occurred in Washington and New York. Today, we're going to go back to another terror attack 22 years ago this coming Sunday. Archbishop Oscar Romero was assassinated in San Salvador. He was gunned down while celebrating Mass at the Divine Providence Cancer Hospital in San Salvador. Oscar Romero was killed by graduates of the U.S. Army School of the Americas, members of death squads allied with the U.S.-trained Salvadoran security forces. In early 1990, a U.S. congressional task force was formed to investigate the massacre of six Jesuit priests and two others in a separate attack in El Salvador. The task force reported that those responsible were trained at the School of the Americas. Soon after, a group called SOA Watch formed to piece together a history of the military school they began to call the School of the Assassins. Well, the former School of the Americas, based in Fort Benning, Georgia, opened in 1946. It trained Latin American soldiers in combat, counterinsurgency, and counter-narcotics. The school's opponents say SOA's nearly 60,000 graduates are responsible for some of the worst human rights abuses in Latin America. In January of 2001, after over a decade of vigils, fasts, and demonstrations against the school, the House of Representatives voted to cut its funding. The Army closed the School of the Americas, and a month later, the Pentagon opened the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, which trains civilian, military, and law enforcement students with a curriculum similar to the SOA in the same place. Last year, 683 students graduated from the newly named school. Well, today we're joined by the founder of SOA Watch, School of the Americas Watch, Father Roy Bourgeois, who has been living just outside the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, for many years, has been arrested a number of times for crossing the line onto the base. We are also joined by Colonel Mark Morgan, who is a spokesperson for the Pentagon, who works closely with the WISC, the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, the current incarnation of the former School of the Americas. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's start with Father Roy Bourgeois. What progress have you made in your efforts to close the school? It remains after many years.
Well, Amy, let me say we started 11 years ago with about a dozen people. And this last November at the main gate, it's become a tradition that we gather at the main gate of Fort Benning every November to keep alive the memory of the victims, to try and use our voices as North Americans for the victims of this school and our country's foreign policy in Latin America. And last November, we had 10,000 gathered there. About half were college students. We have veterans, senior citizens, lots of nuns, parents with their children. Our movement has grown. It's become very diverse, rooted in nonviolence. And let me just say, what we have here is not a complicated issue. It's a combat school. every year training about 1,200 soldiers from Latin America in combat. Many of them, hundreds of them, have returned to their home countries and have caused untold suffering and death to their people. The well-known victims, we know the Jesuits, the six Catholic priests of the Jesuit order, the mother, her teenage daughter, the four church women who were raped and killed, Archbishop Oscar Romero. But today in Colombia, that we can address later, you know, many being killed there are connected to graduates of the School of the Americas. Most of the soldiers today are there from Colombia. So what we have here is a combat school. It's about men with guns, a school that really we have been identifying for many years as a training camp for terrorists in Latin America.
Colonel Mark Morgan, a training camp for terrorists.
Hi, Amy. Good to be on your program. I want to say hello to Father Roy, who I haven't seen in a while, but we have talked in the past, and it's a pleasure to be here. It's sort of amazing that the rubric of this training terrorist camp for training has come up since September 11th, because this is, again, another use of symbolism, which basically tries to tie this campaign to whatever the latest headline is. Quite frankly, Congress voted to close the School of the Americas and open a new institute in a new direction last year, and it opened in January. And just a comment about the courses there, these are on the school's website. You can go and look at them. Anybody can look at these. 2 points. Most of these courses do not involve arms. They are the same courses given to the U.S. military. They are professional education courses, and in fact, a number of these courses, two right now and eight others, are being accredited to a civilian university, which is Troy State University, which is very close to the campus of the Institute. So you can be a civilian student and walk in and take these courses. So this sort of bombs and bullets doesn't meet reality. Go take a look at the website. These are civilian accredited courses. They are the same as anybody in the U.S. military can take most of them. They're professional development courses.
Father Roy Bourgeois?
Yes, a couple things. I have here a banner that we had 5 years ago as we gathered at the main gate of Fort Benning. It says, "Indict the School of the Americas for Terrorism." We have been referring to this school as a school for terrorists for many, many years. About the course catalog, actually the new list that was just given to me last week by Colonel Richard Downey, the new commandant of the school, I just quote a couple of the courses that you talk about here. The instructor course, talking about methods of instruction, communication skills, and interaction and control techniques. That's very alarming. Another course here, the Cadet Leadership Development Course. Students learn basic light infantry squad and platoon operations and air assault operations. And one other I should mention, having just returned a few months ago from Colombia, where we're sending all of these Black Hawk helicopters accompanying these low-flying planes that spray in the glyphosate, the strong chemical that's killing not only the Cocalese, but the food sources of the indigenous people there and causing a lot of health problems for their children. I have here in your course catalog Cadet Troop Leader Training Course, where they learn night operations and air movement capabilities with the Black Hawk helicopters. And this, of course, is very alarming to us. We hear you say that this school is very benign, teaching democracy. There is now at your school, I live right outside of the main gate, and we were met, the 10,000 of us, as we gathered there in November with the 9-foot chain link fence topped with barbed wire, and every 15 feet I have here a sign that says, "No trespassing." And we ask a basic question, Colonel: how do you teach democracy behind a barbed wire fence? How do you teach democracy or human rights behind the barrel of a gun?
Well, Father Roy, if I go ahead, Amy, I'm it's nice to hear you paraphrase Chairman Mao, but be that as it may, let me quote one comment from the Cadet Troop Leader Training Course Catalog, which is a 2-week course which you sort of saw infamous nefarious things going on. It says, "Students receive instruction on the concept of civilian control over the armed forces in the U.S. democratic process. Student training is reinforced to students through field trips and local area allowing to experience U.S. society and introducing them to local customs and lifestyle." So this is nothing more than high school courses where they study. Where you see control techniques, you are, I don't know what you're reading into this. because it's not there. The institute is open. Because of the terrorist attacks, any military base in the United States right now, you need to call ahead and get on, and you need basically permission because of force protection issues. But you know full well that if you call ahead or any of the listeners want to visit the Institute, all they need to do is call the Public Affairs Office and say, I would like to come on and visit, and they can walk in.
Colonel, you have sent 70 of our people, including, actually, we've got, we have 23 of our people just 2 months ago released from federal prison, serving 6 months, 19-year-old college student Rachel Hayward from Kalamazoo College, and also an 88-year-old Catholic nun by the name of Sister Dorothy Hennessy. You should be very familiar with her case. She, along with 70 of our people over the years, have been imprisoned for going on to that fort. Now, let me say again, we do not understand how you can call this an open base. If we went on there now, we would be arrested. And again, I stand by what I said. How do you teach democracy behind a sign that says no trespassing? If we went on to Fort Benning, I and others would be arrested and hauled off to prison.
Father Roy, if you wanted to go on and visit the Institute, we have told you several times that we will personally lift your ban and bar letter. You have an invitation to come on. You will not be arrested if you tell us you want to come
that.
On.
I'm sorry. I cannot take that risk.
Anybody who has been arrested and wants to come on and is not going to conduct civil disobedience is welcome in the Institute.
But if we can talk about something very important, because I returned with a delegation from our SOA Watch movement to Colombia a few months ago. Most of your soldiers there are from Colombia, and we're very alarmed about this Plan Colombia, the $1.3 billion that we're pumping into Colombia now, which I see as another Vietnam, speaking as a Vietnam veteran, another Vietnam in the making, some say another El Salvador. We talked, of course, to the high-ranking generals. I have here a photograph of Colonel General Montoya, a graduate of the school with his M16 that he proudly wears over his shoulder. Of course, that we armed him with, along with all of these other soldiers there in Colombia. But of course, General Montoya and the military is very happy with this money. It enriches them, gives them more power and control over their people. But then we went to Putumayo to meet with the indigenous leaders. And I can only say they were very, very angry at us because it's this strong chemical, deadly, called glyphosate, produced by Monsanto, who brought us Agent Orange in Vietnam, spraying the coca leaves, of course, that we get from the cocaine here. Now, it's killing not only the cocoa leaves. I have here photographs that we took, the banana crops, the yuca, the rice destroyed. Here are huge areas of the country simply wiped out. More plants, their banana crops just devastated, burnt by this strong chemical. But then it's going into their rivers, polluting their streams, killing their fish. But they brought us to see their children in their humble homes where they're suffering from these skin rashes, a lot of sores, their children with these serious respiratory problems. And they had a basic question for us. How would we feel if we had this chemical dropped on our homes, our crops, our children? We would be outraged. And what they also said, and I'll end here, they said, what we're really after is those huge, very, very large oil reserves on their land to feed our addiction to oil. We will get at that however we can get at it, and this is the plan to drive them off of their land. And I think what they're saying is very true.
Father Roy Bourgeois, what does that have to do with School of the Americas or the current Western Hemisphere Institute?
Well, first of all, most of the soldiers at the School of the Americas, and we still refer to it as the SOA because very little has changed here. It's a new name, but the same shame. It's still about combat courses with a little window dressing. Most of the soldiers trained at this school from Colombia go back. What we also heard and saw was how the military from Colombia we're training is very, very closely allied to the paramilitary forces there, who are really identified as an official terrorist organization by our State Department. And coming from our U.S. ambassador there also, how closely the military and the paramilitary work together.
Colonel Mark Morgan.
I agree with you, Amy. Father Roy is all over the place, and I really do believe his heart's in the right place, but his argument is with foreign policy. And he uses this institute, which has been investigated, it's new, it's been endorsed by Congress, as a symbol to bring a lot of people together who disagree with foreign policy. But let me put the premise here, because this is really not about Colombia. It's not about counter-drug. And in fact, if you look at the course load for last year, I think only 8 of the 100-something Colombians went to the counter-drug course. It is about trying to solve the problems of Latin America, because the militaries there are a problem. And I agree with Father Roy here. The problems of the military, they're insular. There have been problems in the past, and they are trying to professionalize in the sense that we see the American military and our role in civil-military relations, which is civilian control of the military, and the fact that we do represent democratic values and how you respect all institutions of society and civil society is the element that we want to put across to the students who come to see us down there. And they will take this back. So this is much broader than Colombia. It is not counter-drug. It is professional military training. And the real issue is that if you're a pacifist and you disagree with that, I respect you. But if you believe there is something special going on at this institute because the instruction is the same at every other institution in the United States, the same doctrine the military teaches, same doctrine we teach the U.S. folks, you know, why aren't we turning into, as Roy might say, little terrorists? It does not make any sense.
Well, Father Roy Bourgeois, what about Colonel Morgan's argument that this is about a school that will professionalize the military?
Well, that's the problem today. They are too professional. You know, we have brought to this school well-known human rights abusers. When you bring soldiers to this school on U.S. soil, a combat school, to teach them commando operations, psychological warfare, counterinsurgency techniques. And you teach them, you bring them in from El Salvador, Guatemala, the most brutal of all militaries, as Jennifer Harberry can attest, and now from Colombia, and you give them an M16 and teach them these techniques, and they go back and they commit these crimes against humanity, you know, there's a complicity involved here. Let me say this. I'll be very frank. I got a call from the commanding general of Fort Benning a week after September the 11th saying that we should not be coming in November to protest, that we're at war with terrorism, that this is no time to be protesting. And we called our leaders all over the country in this movement, and everyone said it is more important than ever for us to go to Fort Benning, gather at the main gate once again, because at the very core of this issue is really violence, terrorism. And our president keeps saying over and over again that we've got to go after these training camps for the terrorists wherever they exist. And we feel a very good place to start is right in our backyard at this school, which we really see and we've been identifying for a long time as a school for terrorists.
Well, Amy, if that's true, Father Roy, I would expect to be down there, downtown New York, protesting at the National Guard Armory, because the training given to any National Guard soldier is the same that goes on at this institute.
What about the record of who comes to the School of the Americas and where they go afterwards, going back to their own countries?
Well, if the legislation and the policy for students there is set by the State Department. This is part of our foreign operations. It also involves the Leahy Law and some other congressional sanctions. Every student who comes in is screened and vetted for any types of violations before they are given a visa to travel to the United States. And once they go back, we normally look at them for about 2 years to see where they go. And
what about someone like Colonel Alperez, who Jennifer Harberry was just talking about, who was involved with the murder of her husband in Guatemala,
well,
a graduate of the School of the Americas?
Right. My comment, again, to Father Roy and everyone else is there are problems in Latin America. I don't make excuses for them, and I condemn all of the atrocities and the very horrible crimes that were committed down there. My question is, what is the cause and effect? Because if you go back to the UN Truth Commission in El Salvador, one of the key findings that I never hear from critics is that it says humans alone possess will and therefore can take decisions based on will. Individuals commit crimes. So these criminals have made a choice on what to do. And if you go back and try to put sort of these notorious grad lists against what type of instruction they received, it doesn't match up.
Father Roy Bourgeois.
The two who murdered Archbishop Romero, one took a radio course, and one took a cadet course 13 years and I think 14 years before the crime. I don't see how you can put cause and effect between that.
But, Colonel,
there
are
a lot of problems in Latin America. There are a lot of social problems,
talking,
and I think that's where you find the roots.
We're not
of
talking about a few bad apples here. We're
talking.
We have documented over 500 of those graduates who have gone to their home countries and have tortured, have raped. I have here front page of the Washington Post, U.S. instructed Latins on executions and torture. There have never been an apology that has come from the Pentagon, from the State Department. They're simply, what we feel so offensive is just changing a name, like this is all going to be fine. Now, let me just say, too, we are going to continue to gather in ever greater numbers at the main gate. We're going to be in Washington, D.C., April the 19th through the 22nd for what we call a Columbia mobilization. The SOA Watch movement, joined by Witness for Peace and 60 other organizations, are coming together. Tens of thousands will gather there. This coming November, we're going to be at the main gate with more than we had last year. We had 10,000 who gathered there. This coming November, we're going to be in ever greater numbers there. We are not going away. I want to say, too, we have in Congress, our viewers should know, H.R. 1810, a simple bill, very important bill, to cut off the funding, the millions of dollars that you are getting to train these terrorists at this school. We want that money going into schools for our children. And for a lot of our viewers who are not familiar with our movement, I would recommend they check out our website. Lots of information, www.soaw.org. And again, very important are the letters to members of Congress to support H.R. 1810 to help us close down what we see really is a school for terrorists.
Amy, can I get my commercial time?
Colonel Morgan, go ahead.
Just a couple of comments. I welcome Father Roy and his group down to Columbus, Georgia, and I support their First Amendment right, and I hope to continue a dialogue. I really do think we're seeking to try to solve the problems in Latin America, and I really don't think that this institute is the problem, because it's the same that goes on every place else. There are six other places that do the same sorts of instruction, so why this?
Where are they?
There is an Air Force school. There is an institute here up in Washington that runs at the Department of Defense level. There's one the Navy runs.
Where is the one the Navy run?
It's in Mississippi, I believe. The Air Force one is in Texas. And then there are teams. I mean, the students come in who...
The one the Air Force runs in Texas, where is that?
I believe it's in Corpus Christi.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go off at that.
But the issue is that this is not unique. So I mean, this is about symbolism. But let me do say, if Father Roy and his folks come down to Columbus, Georgia again, which they are welcome to do,
we'll be there.
I asked them.
And then after that, we go on to these other places.
Asked them to come in and visit the institute, talk to the students, talk to the instructors, and see what's going on, so they can be fully informed. Because when I go out and talk on college campuses, when I go out and do this, it's sort of amazed. I've never heard the other side of the story. All we want is people to come in and look and make an honest evaluation about what is really going
but
on.
Colonel, last November we were there. We were met by this, again, 9-foot fence, top of barbed wire with all these signs. We couldn't get in.
There were 100
Can you
students.
Assure that we will go in? We're going to have about 15,000 people who would like to visit.
There were 100 students that called ahead that we arranged that came in, that were part of your protest, that came in the day before. If somebody goes down there to protest, they're doing themselves a disservice if they do not come in and learn about this place prior to going to your...
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up the discussion. I want to thank Colonel Mark Morgan for joining us from the Pentagon, Father Roy Bourgeois.
Can I give you my
website
once?
Yes.
It's www.benning.army.mil/winsec.
And all of that information will also be on our website at democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to part two of the speech of Johann Galtung, the founder of the academic discipline of peace studies, speaking this weekend at Pace University in New York.
1945, There was a problem in Europe. There was a hated country in its midst, Nazi Germany, which had occupied 18 countries and tried to exterminate two nations, the Jews and the Sinti Roma. The way the Western Europeans handled that problem was not by quarantining it, isolating it, and continuing fighting it. But it was as an equal member. But we would like you to keep a little bit quiet the first 20 years and to foot quite a lot of the bill. And the five neighboring countries were Benelux, France, and Italy. Four of them bordering on Germany, Italy very nearby. It has worked. Germany was accepted as a member. The hatred gradually was reduced. It remained for the longest period, incidentally, in the Netherlands. Why had the Germans been particularly bad? No, but maybe the Dutch were more fundamentalist. It's a part of Het Gereformeerde Kerk, the Calvinist type of Dutch Christianity. Maybe. Well, there are five countries surrounding Israel. And the name of the five countries are Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Egypt. Now, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon correspond to Benelux. Maybe Egypt corresponds to France, and maybe Jordan to Italy. They're bordering on Israel. And one could imagine a Middle East multilateral community built the same way as the European community. There would still be six countries. Decisions would be made by consensus. So I'm thinking of European community as it was from 1967 to 1992, when it changed to European Union. By consensus, with the goal of having tourism, trade, cultural cooperation, economic cooperation of all kinds, co-production, exchange of people, blossom. 1,000 years ago, this was a center of world culture. After the Crusade, it was crippled. The Christian world bears much of the responsibility for that. It could be resurrected. And the Ottoman rule, it was partly, some of it resurrected. That could go much, much further. I've done quite a lot of mediation in the area, and my experience is that this is what reasonable people are dreaming of. Let the borders remain, but be osmotic. And as I remember, one Jordanian journalist said, I want to have my breakfast at the Tiberias in northern Israel, my lunch in Jericho, and my nightlife I can take at Aqaba or Eilat. His father was a rich man, his BMW might possibly do it, but they need a little bit cooperation in straightening out the roads for him to be able to manage it. Now, you can say this is the materialistic side of the dream. That's an important part of it. And there are dreams of that kind being dreamt in the whole region. Behind that is one little point. Israel-Palestine will not be able bilaterally to arrive at an agreement. The agreement is about square meters, not only kilometers, and numbers down to one person. It's about land and numbers. There are too high numbers and too little land, too much quarrel, too much bickering, too much hatred. One has to expand the frame from bilateral to multilateral. Now, this one has today some openings. May probably have to be done without Sharon and Arafat. And it may be both of them could retire to Florida. Maybe even be neighbors. And they could continue. Maybe one could say that they were not that successful. And that there would be a chance for younger generation to take over. And there is today in all the Islamic countries a mobilization of moderate, decent, beautiful Islam against what Edward Said calls these bearded bomb throwers. Now, they would say that Edward Said should watch his beard, which is rather, I would say, in deficit. It's not my debate. I'm just saying that there is a movement in the Islamic world which stands up against fundamentalism, and the same movement will now come in the Western world. The reaction in the European foreign ministries against the current US nuclear document is enormous. It's enormous. And it is not being assuaged by the idea that this is an old plan. As a matter of fact, that makes it even worse. That it has been the pipeline for a long time, and that the leak has come now. The thinking in Western Europe is, to a large extent, that the US government is like an engineer who is running a train, is not in command of the engine and doesn't know which track he's running on. Now, that's an unfair comment. Because why did you join that train if you don't like it? Well, it's an indication that they might jump it. And the question is, what happens then? But they were on that train in the Afghanistan campaign, which I have tried to characterize as a total failure from the stated goal, highly successful from the unstated goal, and that is rather, if you will, imperial politics, confirming exactly the hypothesis about what the whole thing is about that the other side had. Now, one can now add to this dreams about Afghanistan. I know something about what they dream about. And I'm not thinking about a government imposed from the outside, because in addition to a coalition government of all forces, they were dreaming of a federation, not a unitary state run from Kabul and the environment. Saying that what might be interesting for us would be a Swiss-type constitution, modeled on the only country in the world that has managed a multinational country with dignity to all parts and equal dignity. They're interested in a confederation between Afghanistan and neighboring Islamic countries, a Central Asian, maybe Central South Asian confederation. They're interested in cooperating with UN, but they want UN to cooperate with the Organization of the Islamic Conference, and their argument is very strong. In the nucleus of the Security Council in the UN, there are four Christian countries and one Confucian. And they ask embarrassing questions like, how would you like to be run by Security Council with four Muslim countries and one Confucian, China? It would, of course, be immediately denounced by the West as impossible. So they say, we have 56 Islamic countries in the world, why should we accept it? Bring in the Organization of the Islamic Conference. They want a basic needs-oriented policy. And this is a point where they see the Taliban's as good at law and order, as good at abolishing opium, and as good at basic needs orientation, but not for women. So that has to be corrected. That's why they don't want 100% Taliban. Now, there is one thing they're particularly strong on, non-interference from abroad. They've had enough of it. And that's the situation in which they are now. So if I put the kind of thinking that came forth in February last year in Peshawar, where this group was met, with people drifting back and forth to Kabul all the time, then what we have today is exactly the opposite of what they expressed. And the prediction is dismal. Continuation of the war, incessant continuation. The US trying to define everything that happens as Al-Qaeda or surviving Taliban, whereas in fact there are at least three, four other things happening at the same time. I'll conclude by saying, the forces against the madness of both sides the terrorist and the state terrorist madness are slowly taking shape. You can think of four types of forces. It would be in the Western part and the Islamic part of the world. It would be governmental and non-governmental. It would be the moderates in the Western part and the moderates in the Islamic world. They exist. What we have not managed so far is to connect them. Like the anti-Stalinist dissident movement in Eastern Europe was connected with the anti-nuclear peace movement, actually in 1984 that happened. That connection will come sooner or later. You have governments in the Western world, in the Islamic world, starting protesting. You will have to have access to the newspapers in their country in order to read it. You will not expect ever to learn about it in US main media. You are being lied to, and these lies are there in order to protect the government against protest from its own population. Belongs to the picture that the government orders Pentagon, Hollywood to make 13 movies, propaganda movies, of the same type, falsifying history, as Black Hawk Down, which has nothing to do with reality in Somalia. A total falsification. I would even go as far as to say that Goebbels was an amateur relative to the propaganda that is going on in this country now. He, incidentally, was the one who started using the word terrorist systematically. One terrorist was my father, who was a part of the freedom fighters in my country, Norway. Now, having said that, if these four forces, governmental, non-governmental, Western, Islamic, come together, which will still take some time, it will probably bring the machine to a halt, the killing machine. There has to be a debate inside the US for that to happen, and that is problematic for the time being, but it is coming. And it is astounding how much progress that debate is actually making in its kind of subterranean, little bit clandestine manner, now that we have passed the first 6 months. So all I can say to conclude is that I argue in favor of this third approach, where you take as a point of departure the relationship that went bad, and you simply try to rectify that relationship. The tail end of that process will be reconciliation. The reconciliation will mean that textbooks will have to be rewritten.
Johan Galtung, founder of Peace Studies, speaking this weekend at Pace University. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of the whole speech, which we played a large portion of it yesterday, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. For a videotape, you can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Jeremy Scahill, and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We are broadcasting from Downtown Community Television, just blocks from Ground Zero. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Tomorrow we'll look at Vice President Cheney's trip through the Middle East as he tries to drum up support for a renewed attack on Iraq. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.